The sweet, melancholy strains of Vivaldi's Winter Largo remind us that it's time once again for Evening Under Lamplight, with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. The website is momentsunderlamplight.com. The email, rla@momentsunderlamplight.com. And the moment is now, and you're invited now to attend. Now, at the end of the year, we might be haunted by all the things we've lost, all the people we've lost too, of course. Everyone around us is pulling us up to have a good time, but Evening Under Lamplight comes to the joy only through the loss first. Our theme for this week certainly is Lost and Found. Never just loss, always lost and its partner found. We'll start with the song by the Kinks called, well, Lost and Found, written about Hurricane Gloria, which hit New York on September 27th, 1985. There had been no storm this bad to hit New York for many years, which made it feel even more threatening. And of course, the media inflamed the panic, billing it as the storm of the century, as though it was some kind of wrestling match or Broadway musical or something. The damage was great, but not as great as was expected. People came through all right. They were lost in the storm and found to be okay afterwards. Ray Davis, of course, gets excited by the approaching disaster. Waiting for the hurricane to hit New York City. Somebody said it's hit the bay. This is the nitty-gritty. And all the bag ladies better put their acts together. We're near the eye of the storm. This is really heavy weather. This thing is bigger than the both of us. It's going to put us in our place. We were lost and found just in time. Now we've got no time to waste. We were lost and found, and we beat the fear. We came through the storm. Now it all seems clear. We were lost and found, standing here, looking at the new frontier. There's that joy when you make it through. They've been lost and found. Found in what sense? By the emergency services? Or did they find themselves, the deeper part of themselves, revealed by the panic and loss of comfort and ease? The point seems that they've beaten the fear, and now they're facing the new frontier. More storms ahead, no doubt, but greater strength to face them.
Somebody said it's hit the bay. This is a nitty gritty. And all the bag ladies better put their acts together. We're near the eye of the storm. This is really heavy weather. We were lost and found in the nick of time. While the ship was going down, we were lost. Just in time, with a hurricane crossing the coastline. We were lost and found, just in time. This thing is bigger than the both of us. It's gonna put us in our place. Just in time, now we've got no time to waste. Oh. They're putting up the barricades because a hurricane is heading up this way. So won't you come in from the cold and the pouring rain?
in the pouring rain, when the hurricanes whip across the coastline. This thing is bigger than the both of us. It's gonna put us in our place. We're gonna say what really matters when we see that storm stare us in the face. We beat the fear. We came through the storm. Now it all seems clear. We were lost and found, standing here, looking at the new frontier. Lost and found, just in time, with the hurricane crossing the coastline. With the hurricane crossing the coastline.
That was the Kinks, Lost and Found, with some odd backup bits if you attend carefully. And I have another song for us, also called Lost and Found, by the people you know I love, the Fraggle Rock crew. The sad sack Fraggle, Boober, is under the illusion that he will remain strong and brave as long as he wears his special hat. He loses the hat, though, and thinks his life is at an end. "I'll just stay here until I die," he says. "Give me 10 minutes." But his friends help him find his hat, and the whole group of friends break into this song to celebrate. It's a simple song, basically three stanzas, elaborating on the cliché that you don't know what you've lost until it's found, with a joyful wisdom that only the prematurely aged will fail to love. The song doesn't ignore the pain of loss, but it turns around to celebrate the joy of found. You don't know how it tastes until you try. You don't know how to laugh till you cry. You don't know where you've been till you're homeward bound, and you don't know what you've lost until it's found. Once I thought the world was made for me. Once I thought experience was free. Never knew you'd have to pay a price. Now I've found you sometimes pay it twice. Now I've done some living and I know everything you gain is bound to go. Then one day my luck just turned around. The thing I loved and lost is lost and found.
You don't know how it tastes until you try. You don't know how to laugh until you cry. You don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound. And you don't know what you've lost until it's found. Yodel, 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 yodel,
me.
Once I thought experience was free.
Sing it, Pokey.
Now I've done some living and I know.
Tell us about it.
Everything you gain is bound to go.
That's true.
Well, then one day my luck just turned around.
I know that.
The thing I loved and lost is lost and found.
Oh, you don't know how it tastes until you try. You don't know how.
Fraggle Rock, Lost and Found. I can play that song over and over and not lose interest. Its celebration of finding something lost is like that man who had 100 sheep and left them all to search for the one sheep that was lost. And when he found it, he layeth it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he cometh home, he calleth together his friends and neighbors, saying unto them, Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. There's an art to living with loss, a certain lightness of touch, I suppose, that attitude that realizes that no matter what the pain of the loss, life is not at an end. And if it's an art, then it's something we can practice and get better at. Here's how Elizabeth Bishop puts it in her Villanelle One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
I love you. Morning, our kisses deep and warm, your hair upon the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us, I know that we are not new. In city and in forest, they smiled like me and you, but now it's come to distances and both of us must try. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. Mm-hmm. for another as I wander in my time. Walk me to the corner, our steps will always rhyme. You know my love goes with you as your love stays with me. It's just the way it changes, like the shoreline and the sea. But let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. I loved you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your head on the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us, I know that we are not new. In city and in forest they smiled like me and you. But let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye.
Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, followed by Leonard Cohen's Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye, from his first album. And now we come to a story time segment of the show, a story from Rumi called The Lost Camel, in Coleman Barks' loose and beautiful translation, and read by Coleman Barks himself. The story reminds us that we're all looking for our camel that's been lost, an inevitable loss. And as we enter into a search that is essentially a mystery, we will, at an unpredictable time, find our lost camel. There we were in the bright and promising morning, waiting to load our goods onto the camel to set off with the others in the caravan, but we discover that our camel is gone. It has somehow escaped. We ask others for help, but they are just making things up, not offering any real help. Random, concocted fictions come from every idle bystander, Rumi says. We are pulled one way or another with their descriptions of the unseen, of that thing we have temporarily lost. Everyone has a different story about this loss, but none of these stories is entirely true or entirely false. The true is always near the false. There is wheat threaded in with the barley, he says, and an element of the true dervish lives in each scoundrel. There are prophetic moments and false leads, including, as Coleman Barks puts it, describing the painful experience of loss, the full crucifixion of winter, so the thieving human heart can be exposed and expanded. In this water and clay place, the soul must be torn to let in light. Fear and hunger, poverty and disease, hopes, all these do that work. Threats and promises mingle in our traveling bag. And back to the camel. Yes, it's lost, and you've been given lots of advice and directions. These casual clues are not much help. And then there's one who is there by your side, helping you out. He's not lost his camel, but he says he has, to join your search. His peculiar scam is that he sees how valuable your camel is to you, so he wants part ownership in the search. This is the imitator's strategy. He claims his own value by joining up with yours. No motive or discernment of his own. He has none of that true inspiration you've had, no intensity or certainty, but he gets some inkling of what it might be like to be close to finding one's lost camel. And he has indeed lost a camel, but he does not know it. imitating you has blinded him, but he follows, and suddenly he sees his own camel, which he didn't know he'd lost. Now he's a true seeker, on his own true search. No longer a fake, trying to be part of another's glory. Now that I have separated myself, he tells you, I am truly connected to you, because I know now what you are doing. Before, I was just stealing camel descriptions. Now my spirit has seen its own camel, and that seeing fills everything. My insincerity and copycat words have changed to virtues because they brought me here. That reminds me of a story Jack Kornfield told on a recent podcast. Every month, the disciple who was sent away after years of training faithfully sent his master an account of his spiritual progress. In the first month, he wrote, I feel an expansion of consciousness and experience oneness with the universe. The master glanced at the note and threw it away. 2 months later, he received a note. I finally discovered the holiness that is present in all things. The master seemed disappointed, crumpled it, and threw it into the trash. In his third letter, 2 months later, the disciple enthusiastically explained, The mystery of the one and the many has been revealed to my wondering gaze. The master yawned. The next letter said, No one is born, and no one dies. No one lives. The self is not. The master threw this into the trash and threw his hands up in despair. Months passed, then a year, a second year. The master thought it was time to remind his disciple that he'd promised to keep him informed of his spiritual progress. The disciple wrote back, Who cares what you think? When the master read these words, a great look of satisfaction spread over his face. Thank God, he said, he got it at last. You can hear more of Jack Kornfield's wonderful podcasts, and they really are wonderful, by looking them up under the name Heart Wisdom. But to return to Coleman Barks and Rumi, and the surprise of finding yourself at home all the time. There are, we're now told, not two camels. There is only one lost camel. Because we are all one, and we are, though we seldom realize this, all searching in different ways for that same lost camel. Here's Coleman Barks with David Darling on cello right by his side.
The story of the man looking for his lost camel. Everyone is like someone whose camel has strayed. You have been looking for it diligently, and you will certainly know it when you find it, this camel, this mare that is lost from your herd. It is a mystery how she wanders off in the morning just as the caravan workers are loading up. You have searched the area all day frantically with parched lips, not stopping even for a drink of water. Now the caravan has gone. Night is coming. The goods your camel was to carry have been left beside the road for any thief to take. Has anyone seen the camel that escaped from my stable this morning? There was this reddish one going toward that pasturage over there. Crop-eared, yes, I saw the rascal. Did it have an embroidered saddle blanket? People are just making things up. Ah, the one-eyed one. Badly taken with the mane, she was. random concocted fictions come from every idle bystander. This is how we are pulled, one way and another, by various descriptions of what cannot be described, the unseen, what we have temporarily lost. A philosopher argues with a scholastic theologian. They disprove each other's premise. Someone else mocks both of them. Another very ploddingly tells the way that he is found. Each remembers a home village, though they have never been there. But understand this, none of what these describers say is entirely true, and none of it is completely false. Nothing can be shown or seen as false without the true being somewhere nearby. Fool's gold is such because we know what real gold is. If there were no genuine, how could we detect the fake? So do not say the world is all fantasy and error. There is wheat threaded in with the barley. Some taste of the night of power comes with every night's descending. An element of the true dervish lives in each scoundrel. If everything were faulty, discernment would be of no use. If everything were perfect, any clown could offer wisdom. There are prophetic beings and moments that give us knowing, and there are colors and pleasures that lead us into foolishness. Rub both eyes and look again at this strange combining. God said, "Gaze up into the sky. Do you see any flaws? Now bend toward the ground with your contemplative eyes. Every season is an alchemical process bringing distinctions into view. Dust-colored rubies. The ocean's elaborate tracery. Wind and lightning. What is here? That is the question. Say how it goes. Strand by strand. Nothing. What do you mean? The questioning goes on. In the gentle kindness of spring, and in the cloudy menace of fall, then the full crucifixion of winter, so that the thieving human heart can be exposed and expanded in this water and clay place. The soul must be torn to let in light. Fear and hunger, poverty and disease, hopes, all these do that work. Threats and promises mingle in our traveling bag. Moses' mother gives him her breast for a time, then sets him adrift in the bulrush cradle boat. The taste of mother's milk is that time in pre-existence when we joyfully responded to the divine question, "Am I not your Lord?" with a yes, so immediate and synchronous, the question and the answer wove together in one sound. That taste of mother milk in our throat allows us to tell false from true and to make the complicated decisions about other tastes we are given. The lost camel again, my trusted friend. It is true you have lost your camel. Everyone is offering you advice and giving you directions where to look. All you know for sure is that your camel is gone, and that these casual clues are not much help. There is even someone here who has not lost a camel, who has joined the search for yours. He says, "Yes, I have lost my camel too, just like this man." A reward for whoever finds it. His peculiar scam is that he sees how valuable your camel is to you, so he wants part ownership in the search. This is the imitator's strategy. When you say in response to a suggestion, "No, that is not relevant," the pretender immediately says the same. He has no motive or discernment of his own. He copies you in everything. He has never had the true experience of inspiration that you have. When good information comes, you sense it instantly as your body recognizes the right medicine. Color comes to your face, strength to your limbs. Your eyes brighten. Your feet get lively and agile. You feel grateful. You ask to be led. Please go in front. You know the scent of my camel better than I do. The imitator does not feel such intensity or certainty. He hears your outcries, though, and gets some inkling of what it might be like to be close to finding one's lost camel. And he has indeed lost a camel, but he does not know it. Wanting and imitating someone else's wanting has blinded him, but still he follows along, calling out what others call out. Suddenly, he sees his own camel browsing there in the meadow in front of him. The one he did not know that he had lost. Only then does he become a seeker. He turns aside and goes by himself toward the camel. The sincere seeker asks, why have you left the search? Up until now, I was a fake. I was flattering you because I wanted to be part of your glory. Now that I have separated myself, I am truly connected to you because I know now what you are doing. Before, I was just stealing camel descriptions. Now my spirit has seen its own camel. And that seeing fills everything. My insincerity and copycat words have changed to virtues because they brought me here. I was sowing my seed, but I thought I was doing something else, like a thief. I crept and entered a house, and it was my own home. Be fiery, cold one, so heat can come. Endure the rough surfaces that smooth you. The subject of this is not two camels. There is only one lost camel. But language has difficulty saying that. Muhammad said, whoever knows God stammers. Like an astrolabe pointing to the sky. How much, really, can such a mechanical device reveal about the wheeling universe, especially of that other sky, to which this is a piece of straw? That other sun, to which this one is a momentarily illuminated speck.
Well, that was something, wasn't it? If we imitate the genuine people, then it seems we will eventually lose our fakeness and find our own genuine self, find our own true camel. Muhammad said, whoever knows God stammers. Words are inadequate to express what we know. We go indirectly to what we're looking for, and we can only give hints and guesses to others on the search. That's why we need art to help us to the truth. Art stammers in the sense that it never comes out and tells us anything directly. It speaks through figures of speech and symbols. It makes us search for the camel lost in the art. All of us looking for that same camel, but each from a different direction and in different ways. Whoever knows God stammers. The moral is, of course, don't trust that person who pretends to know all the answers. But here's someone we can trust, someone who knows all the stories, but knows that the deepest answers remain in mysteries, hidden within the stories. I want to play you a bit from a dialogue between Joseph Campbell, the great American master of myths, and Bill Moyers, a master interviewer. Watch how Moyers leads Campbell into these subjects, which he's passionately ready to share with us. You'll see that the connection to Rumi comes in the title of the story Campbell tells us, called Camel to Lion to Child. Then we move on to one of Campbell's most famous pieces of advice, follow your own bliss. See what you think.
What is that story about, and I forget where it comes from, about the camel and then the lion, and along the way you lose the burden of youth?
The three transformations of the spirit.
Yeah.
That's Nietzsche. That's the prologue to Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Tell me that story.
When you are a child, when you are young and a young person, you are a camel. The camel gets down on its knees and says, put a load on me. This is obedience. This is receiving the instruction and information that your society knows you must have in order to live a competent life. When the camel is well loaded, he gets up on his feet, struggles to his feet, and runs out into the desert, where he becomes transformed into a lion. The heavier the load, the more powerful the lion. The function of the lion is to kill a dragon. And the name of the dragon is Thou Shalt. And on every scale of the dragon, there is a Thou Shalt imprinted. Some of it comes from 2,000 years, 4,000 years ago. Some of it comes from yesterday morning's newspaper headline. When the dragon is killed, the lion is transformed into a child, an innocent child living out of its own dynamic. And Nietzsche uses the term ein aus sich rollendes Rad, a wheel rolling out of its own center. That's what you become. That is the mature individual. The Thou Shalt is a civilizing force. It turns a human animal into a civilized human being. But then the one who is thrown off the Thou Shalt is still a civilized human being. You see, he has been humanized, you might say, by the Thou Shalt system. So his performance now as a child is not simply childlike at all. He has assimilated the culture and thrown it off as a Thou Shalt. But this is the way in any artwork. You go to work and study an art. You study the techniques. You study all the rules. And the rules are put upon you by a teacher. Then there comes a time of using the rules, not being used by them. Do you understand what I'm saying? So one way is to follow. I always tell my students, follow your bliss.
Follow your bliss?
Your bliss, where the deep sense of being in form and going where your body and the soul want to go. When you have that feeling, then stay with it and don't let anyone throw you off. Have you ever read Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt?
Not in a long time.
Do you remember the last line? I've never done the thing I wanted to in all my life.
Quite a
bit. That's the man who never followed his bliss. Well, I heard that line. I was living in Brownsville when I was teaching at Sarah Lawrence. Before I was married, I used to be eating out in the restaurants of the town for my lunch and dinners. And Thursday night was the maid's night off in Brownsville, so that all the families were out in the restaurants. And one fine evening, I was in my favorite restaurant there. It was a Greek restaurant. And at a table were sitting a father, a mother, and a scrawny little boy, about 12 years old. The father says to the boy, drink your tomato juice. And the boy says, I don't want to. And the father, with a louder voice, says, drink your tomato juice. And the mother says, don't make him do what he doesn't want to do. The father looks at her and she says, he can't go through life doing what he wants to do. Said, if he does only what he wants to do, he'll be dead. Look at me. I've never done the thing I wanted to in all my life. I said, my God, Babbitt incarnate. Mm. And that's the man who never followed his bliss. Well, you may have a success in life, but then just think of it. What kind of life was it? What good is it? You've never done the thing you wanted to in all your life.
What happens when you follow your bliss?
You come to bliss. This should be it in marriage. I mean, that's the sense of the marriage ceremony. In the Middle Ages, a favorite image that occurs in many, many contexts is the wheel of fortune. There's the hub of the wheel, and there's the revolving rim of the wheel. And if you are attached to the rim of the wheel, let's say fortune, you will be either above, going down at the bottom, or coming up. But if you are at the hub, you're in the same place all the time. And that's the sense of the marriage vow. You know, I take you in health or sickness, you know, in wealth or poverty, but I take you, and you are my bliss. Not the wealth that you might bring me, nor the social prestige, but you. And that's following your bliss. Now, I came to this idea of bliss because in Sanskrit, which is the great spiritual language of the world, and they know all about it and have known about it for a long time. The transcendent is transcendent. But there are three terms that bring you to the brink. You might say the jumping off place to the ocean. And the three terms are Sat, Chit, Ananda. And Sat, the word Sat means being. Chit means full consciousness. And Ananda means rapture. So I thought, I don't know whether my consciousness is full consciousness or not. I don't know whether my being is proper being or not, but I do know where my rapture is. So let me hang on to rapture, and that'll bring me both being and full consciousness, and it works.
What was your rapture?
Well, it started with Indians, and then it went on into more and more mythological matters and the realm of the arts, music, and when I met Jean, then the dance came in, and this is it. Just stay with that.
And one doesn't have to be a poet to do this. Carpenters do it.
A poet is simply one who's made a profession and a lifestyle of being in touch with that. Most people have to be concerned with other things. They get themselves involved in economic and other activities, or you're drafted into a war that isn't the one you're interested in. And how to hold to this umbilical, you might say, in those circumstances. That's a technique each one has to work out for himself somehow. But most people living in that realm of what might be called occasional concerns, they all have the capacity that's waiting to be awakened to move to this other place. I know it. I've seen it happen in students. A wonderful way of teaching we had at Sarah Lawrence, where I taught for 38 years, I'd have an individual conference with every one of my students at least once a fortnight for half an hour or so. And there you're talking on about the things that students ought to be reading, and suddenly you hit on something that the student really responds to. You can see the eyes open, the complexion changes, the life possibility has opened there. And all you can say to yourself is, I hope this child hangs on to that, you know. They may or may not. But when they do, they've found a life right there in the room with you.
How would you advise somebody to tap that spring of eternal life, that joy that is right there?
Well, we're having experiences all the time, which may, on occasion, render some sense of this, a little intuition of where your joy is. Grab it. No one can tell you what it's going to be. I mean, you've got to learn to recognize your own depths.
Do you ever have this sense when you're following your bliss, as I have at moments, of being helped by hidden hands?
All the time. It's miraculous. I even have a superstition that has grown on me as the result of invisible hands coming all the time. Namely, that if you do follow your bliss, you put yourself on a kind of track that has been there all the while waiting for you. And the life that you ought to be living is the one you're living somehow. And when you can see it, you begin to deal with people who are in the field of your bliss, and they open doors to you. I say, follow your bliss and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be.
Do you ever have sympathy for the man who has no invisible means of support?
Who has no invisible means? Yes, he's the one that evokes compassion, you know, the poor chap. And to see him stumbling around when the water of immortal life is right there it evokes one's pity.
Right there? Right there? You believe that?
Yes.
The waters of eternal life?
Right there.
Where?
Wherever you are. If you're following your bliss. I mean, you're having that joy, that refreshment, that life all the time.
That's Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers. Campbell knows well what true education is about. Not stuffing the student with knowledge, not assessing the student's achievements, but helping the students find their blissful direction and encouraging them. Everything else is not education, but training. Training loads our camel with a heavier burden to carry. We need that burden, all those thou shalt. But then education helps us transform into a lion so we can slay that dragon thou shalt and become a child and start fresh again, grounded in who we are, not in what they told us we should be. That also means, of course, that we take responsibility for what we do and accept the necessary losses and pains. And finding your bliss, doing what your inner self dictates rather than what society tells you, is just what Walt Whitman is doing. And here's the remarkable thing. Because Whitman is grounded in himself, in his own bliss, as Campbell would say, then and only then is he able to open out to everyone else. Because he has found himself, then he can also find everyone else and be of them. Listen as he continues in this long catalogue we have been following, as here he identifies himself with people all across America. Everything and everyone is in his, her, or its own place, and at the same time is connected with everyone and everything else. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, Blake said. And it's Whitman's excessive, joyful reaching out that leads him to his wise vision of the world. How can anyone harbor prejudice or hostility to others with this vision? Listen. I am of old and young, of the foolish as much as the wise, regardless of others, ever regardful of others. Maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man, stuffed with the stuff that is coarse and stuffed with the stuff that is fine. One of the great nation, the nation of many nations, the smallest the same and the largest the same, a southerner as soon as a northerner, a planter nonchalant and hospitable, a Yankee bound my own way, ready for trade. My joints, the limberest joints on earth, and the sternest joints on earth. A Kentuckian walking the vale of the Elkhorn in my deerskin leggings. A boatman over the lakes or bays or along coasts. A Hoosier, a Badger, a Buckeye, a Louisianian or Georgian, a poke-easy from Sandhills and Pines, at home on Canadian snowshoes or up in the bush, or with fishermen off Newfoundland. At home in the fleet of ice boats, sailing with the rest and tacking. At home on the hills of Vermont, or in the woods of Maine, or the Texan ranch. Comrade of Californians, comrade of free Northwesterners, loving their big proportions. Comrade of raftsmen and coal men. Comrade of all who shake hands and welcome to drink and meet. A learner with the simplest, a teacher of the thoughtfulest, a novice beginning experient of myriads of seasons, of every hue and trade and rank, of every caste and religion, not merely of the New World, but of Africa, Europe, or Asia, a wandering savage, a farmer, mechanic, or artist, a gentleman, sailor, lover, or Quaker, a prisoner, fancy man, rowdy, lawyer, physician, or priest. I resist anything better than my own diversity, and breathe the air, and leave plenty after me, and am not stuck up, and am in my place. The moth and the fish eggs are in their place. The suns I see and the suns I cannot see are in their place. The palpable is in its place, and the impalpable is in its place. And we too are in our place, me at the mic, you wherever you are as you listen to this. Each in our own place, yet each connected to the other through Evening Under Lamplight. On Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. And this is Robert Louis Abrahamson, hoping that the things you've loved and lost, things like your camel, or your place in the world, or your place within, your bliss, hoping that all these lost things will soon be lost and found. Good night.